Today is June 29th, 2016. My name is Rob Mason, and I'm the Student Project Coordinator of the Allard Law History Project. Joining me today is Lindsay Lister. Welcome, Lindsay.
Thank you.
So, as a law student, one of the first things that jumped out at me about your resume was that you were the gold medalist of your class in 1991. Mm-hmm. So I can only begin to imagine the level of effort and hard work that went into that.
I'm sure you can imagine. If you're a student right now, you can imagine.
Yeah. So I want to start by asking, what motivated you to work as hard as you did in law school?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I really loved it. I mean, I've always been, I've usually been motivated to work hard in school. That actually wasn't always true in my undergrad. But when I came to law school, I just really loved it. It was really intellectually engaging. I loved the combination of, you know, the reading, the analysis, the writing. And although that maybe wasn't absolutely self-evident, say, in first year when I was really, really working hard,
sure.
the possibility of connecting that with real-world problems, real people, was just really attractive to me. So, yeah, fell in love.
And has that been consistent throughout your career?
Yeah, it really has. I mean, the reason I went to law school was because I hoped that... I knew nothing about being a lawyer. There were no lawyers in my family. Knew nothing. But I hoped that it would provide the opportunity for a career that would combine intellectual engagement and social, we didn't really use the word social justice in those days, but
right.
doing good in the world.
Sure.
And it's absolutely been that for me.
So let's rewind a little bit to your origins. Could you tell me a bit about where you grew up?
Sure. I grew up in Armstrong, which is a small town at the north end of the Okanagan Valley. I grew up in a ranch.
Mm-hmm.
I was a complete ranch girl, had my own cattle, 4-H, all that kind of business, going off to the bull sales with my dad. Then got out of Dodge as pretty much as quickly as I could, which was actually more difficult than I make it sound by saying that, because I loved actually the ranch life.
Yeah.
But I knew I wanted to go to university, so I went to the University of Victoria,
mm-hmm.
where I did my degree in history. And actually, while I was in Victoria, I thought about a lot of different careers, but actually what I was most motivated to do for quite a long time was to become an Anglican priest. That didn't end up happening. Although, while I was going to law school, I was living at the Vancouver School of Theology because my then husband was a theological student there.
Hmm. What changed your mind?
Oh, now that's a long story. Well, church and I had a bit of a falling out, I'll just say that.
Okay, well, we can leave it at that. So, I guess... what did your history degree bring to your preparation for law school? Did you feel that it was a good...
Excellent background. I think any liberal arts education is a good background for law.
Mm-hmm.
That came home to me, actually, when I later taught law in terms of the backgrounds that seemed to be most helpful for people in studying law. I love history, and so, you know, the ability to kind of look at the roots of both legally, politically, socially, of where law came from.
Right.
And so I was one of those geeky people that would love it if the professor gave the long extended history of how did we get to the current legal doctrine.
Right.
just the ability to think critically, to read a lot, to analyze. I thought history was a great background for law.
Was there anything you felt unprepared for in law school?
Trace or that the surprised races.
You? Okay.
I don't know if they still do those. It surprised me. I don't think there was anything I particularly felt unprepared for. I think I felt very well prepared for law school, although I didn't know that when I went in. I remember, I think, my first day of class,
yeah.
taking torts. I was with then-Dean Peter Burns.
Mm.
And I didn't have a clue what a tort was. And but I'm a cook. I cook and a baker. I knew what a hazelnut tort was.
Right.
But I was just, you know, and Professor Burns was of the Socratic method, great professor. Mm-hmm. But I was quite terrified, you know, that I was going to be expected to know what a tort was, and I didn't have the first clue. However, you know, soon I learned what a tort was, and I felt very well prepared for law school. Something that surprised me. I think I could say it surprised me. It certainly wasn't my favorite aspect of law school. Was the probably small but nonetheless significant percentage of students for whom it was, is this going to be on the exam? Mm. Kind of the very kind of mechanical approach of what do I have to do
right.
to get this degree in order to go on, as opposed to having any real seeming interest or passion for the law.
Speaking of passion for the law, what courses specifically interested you most as a student? Or professors stood out for you?
Yeah, well, constitutional law for sure. Professor mm-hmm. Elliott was a terrific professor. Dean Burns was a great professor of tort law. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was funny. Some of the courses I enjoyed the most were really courses I had the least interest in any kind of larger world sense. Like real estate law. I was with Professor Woolley. He was a really good professor. Mm-hmm. I had zero interest in actually knowing how to do a real estate conveyance.
Sure.
But it was like a puzzle. Mm-hmm. So the courses that gave you kind of that intellectual put like conflicts. You know, even though you might never, ever actually think about that particular substantive law area again in future,
right.
I don't think I ever have in the case of, other than in buying and selling a house, perhaps.
Yeah.
But it was just fun, you know. But in terms of the substantive stuff, the constitutional law for sure.
One of the most obvious changes to law school over its history has been the number of women in the class mm. and in the legal profession. Mm-hmm. Was the gender gap still noticeable to you as a student, or
no.
did it affect you?
No, not amongst the student body.
Yeah.
I think that we were in the majority in terms of students in my year. I think we might have been the first year that was true. I could be slightly off in that, but it's close.
Yeah.
And I know that of all of the highest achieving students academically, a majority were women.
Right.
So in law school, from the point of view of students, no, it wasn't an issue at all.
Right.
There weren't very many female professors. Was it Professor Attinger, speaking of conflicts. There must have been a few more, but they're not coming to mind.
I can look into it. But
an adjunct who taught me criminal law who went on to become a judge. Mm-hmm. I can't remember her name right now. But there weren't very many professors.
Right. And then going into the legal profession, did you find, because there I imagine it was still
absolutely still male dominated. And yes, that was noticeable once you were actually out in practice, for sure.
Yeah.
Although, you know, today I'm a partner in a law firm that's dominated by women.
Right. let's see. Did you participate in any extracurricular activities in law school?
Well, there was the tricycle race, but...
And you participated in that?
I did, actually.
Great.
Les Avocats de Vin. There was a law school wine tasting club.
Okay.
I remember participating in that. But I don't think... I didn't do LSLAP.
Mm-hmm.
I was pretty focused on my studies.
Right.
I think that'd probably be about it. It might have been some other things, but that's all I can remember right now.
Okay, and after law school, you clerked for Madam Justice McLaughlin at the Supreme Court of Canada. How did that come about?
Well, back to Dean Burns.
Yeah.
So, of course, Madam Justice McLaughlin had been a professor here at UBC, of course.
Right.
And Dean Burns knew her. And while I was, while I was still in first year taking his torts class, or it might have been in the summer after first year, because I was a research assistant for Dean Burns, he introduced me to Justice McLaughlin organized a very fancy dinner with her and her no, she wasn't married to Frank yet. Me and my husband was there, Tim Burns and his wife. Anyway, so introduced me to her, and she offered me the job over dinner. So
really?
It was completely not the way it's done now.
Right. No, not at all.
So I never went through the whole process of putting in the general application and going through the rounds of interviews and all that business.
Do you remember what you talked about in your first conversation with her?
I don't.
No.
I think we might have talked about how horrible the library was at the old law school building, but I don't remember what we talked about.
Huh. Well, must have made an impression regardless. So, let's see. Later you got involved with the BC Civil Liberties Association.
Yep.
Could you tell me a bit about that experience?
Yeah, well, I've had a lot of involvement with the Civil Liberties Association over the years. So, after I clerked, I practiced at Heenan Blakey here in Vancouver for about 7 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And left Heenan Blakey, and we can talk about Heenan Blakey if you'd like to, but I came to the point where I knew that wasn't where I wanted to continue to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the opportunity arose to become the policy director at
right.
the Civil Liberties Association, again through a UBC law school connection.
Okay. Who was that?
Phil Bryden, who was a professor here, now dean, I think he's the dean of U of A, maybe. Anyway, he was a professor here,
mm-hmm.
And had also a professional relationship with Heenan Blakey, so I knew him through both of those things, and he was on the board of directors of the Civil Liberties Association,
okay.
and he kind of gave me the entree to go there. Actually, I got that in slightly the wrong order. I spent a year teaching full-time here first. Then I went to the Civil Liberties Association.
After clerking, you went?
No.
Okay.
I clerked.
Yeah.
I was an associate at Heenan Blakey.
Right.
I taught full-time here, full-time as an adjunct for
okay.
a year.
In what course?
I taught federalism, human rights in the workplace, and something else chartery.
Okay.
Charter litigation, maybe. Charter litigation, I think that might have been when I developed
yeah.
a charter litigation course. Then I went for a year as the policy director to the Civil Liberties Association. So I came out here to kind of, because I love teaching.
Okay.
I love working with students. And I kind of wanted to see if maybe that's what I wanted to do next.
Mm.
And I determined that while I love teaching and I love working with students, that wasn't actually what I wanted to do next. So then I went to to be the policy director at the Civil Liberties Association, and Phil was instrumental in connecting me with them. And that was a great job. Civil Liberties Association was much smaller than it is today. We had a staff of three, if I remember correctly, the executive director and the receptionist, jack of all trades and me. So I was there for a year. And then again through Phil Bryden, the opportunity arose to become a member of the Human Rights Tribunal.
Right.
So I was at the Human Rights Tribunal for 8 years, and of course while I was at the Human Rights Tribunal, because I'm going to get back to your question, I couldn't have anything to do with the Civil Liberties Association, because it's a sometimes litigant before the
right.
Human Rights Tribunal, but it
yeah.
would be a potential conflict problem. So I had nothing to do with them for that period of time. Then when I left the tribunal in 2010 to join my firm, one of the first things I did was actually get involved with the Civil Liberties Association, first as a member of their board of directors, and then I was president of the association for about 4 years. I actually just finished my term as president, still on the board, now vice president.
Right. Okay. And would you say that throughout your career there have been consistent issues of importance to you? Or have you sort of jumped over?
Well, I guess there's always specific issues that change over time. I think my resume probably speaks for itself in terms of what my real areas of passion are: equality, rights, and civil liberties.
Right.
some people see there being some tension between equality rights and civil liberties. I think there rarely is. I think it's a rare case where there is. But those are really my motivating passions. And yeah. It's really what drew me into labor law. You know, when I was in law school, the one thing I swore I would never do was mm-hmm. labor law. Swore I wouldn't do labor law. Because I thought, I mean, you have to remember this is in the late 80s in BC, incredibly divisive time. Mm. In terms of labor and labor politics in this province. And it just looked ugly and nasty, like, you know, family law with placards. It just looked horrible. And, of course, and then I absolutely swore the one thing I would never, ever do would be management-side labor law. So what did I end up doing? I ended up being an associate in Blakey practicing labor law on the management side for 7 years. But even on the management side, and certainly now that I'm on the trade union side, I mean, you know, labor law is really a key place in which those kind of principles of equality rights, human dignity, and fundamental freedoms can actually be made real. Through trade unions, there are actually organizations whose goal it is to make those things real
right.
in working people's lives. So that's I like that.
Is there a particular case you've worked on that stands out as being meaningful to you or is making a valuable contribution?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Eldridge. Mm-hmm. So when I was at Heenan Blakey, amongst their many excellent qualities was that they gave me a lot of opportunity to do the stuff I wanted to do, including pro bono.
Yeah.
And so the Eldridge case, I don't know if you're familiar with it. I think
not
probably
really,
still,
no.
They'll still teach it in constitutional law, surprise.
Maybe they did.
It had to do, there was three plaintiffs, all deaf, mm-hmm. who required ASL translation, sign language translation, in order to be able to communicate with their medical providers.
Okay.
And so one of the three plaintiffs was a woman who had just a number of chronic complex health issues. The other two plaintiffs were a couple who had had a very distressing experience during the birth of their children because of a lack of communication. They were both deaf. Mm. Lack of communication between them and their healthcare providers.
Right.
So that case alleged that the failure of the government and so both the Ministry of Health and the hospitals to provide sign language interpretation where it's necessary for meaningful communication in healthcare
right.
was a breach of Section 15 of the Charter. Mm. I was not counsel at trial. Excellent folks at the Community Legal Assistance Society were counsel at trial, but I took it on at the BC Court of Appeal and took it up to the Supreme Court of Canada. Mm. They had lost at trial, essentially in a very formalistic equality analysis.
Okay.
Nobody gets sign language interpretation. How can it be a breach of your equality rights not to get sign language interpretation? And the BC Court of Appeal upheld that decision, but we were able to get it overturned unanimously at the Supreme Court of Canada. And what mm-hmm. was, this was in, I was like a 3 or 4 year call at the time. Mm-hmm. It was a really, a truly landmark decision in the development of equality jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. Also, it's a key case in terms of application of the Charter because hospitals are not themselves government.
Right.
And so when government uses a non-governmental or quasi-governmental, public but non-governmental agency to provide services to the public, does the Charter apply? And it was in Eldridge that Justice Lafferre kind of set out what still is more or less the working test for that question.
Right.
Anyhow,
the refresher helps, I think it is.
It was a fantastic case. There's been lots of other good ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are some changes in the legal profession that you've noticed throughout your career so far?
Well, you already touched on one, of course. I mean, just the change in the demographics is
right.
enormous. Although I don't know what the current statistics are. I remember a few years ago they were still saying that, you know, more than 50% of women, you know, leave the profession within the first 5 years. Maybe more than 50% of lawyers leave the profession within the first 5 years, period. I'm not sure. But certainly the demographics have changed. Not as quickly as one might expect given the demographics of law students. You know? So, I mean, I was talking about my law firm. So we have currently, I always have to count them in my fingers. So we have three partners, two are women, one a man.
Right.
We have one, two, three, four, five associates. They're all women. We have two students, one's a man, one's a woman. We've just hired two more associates. One's a man, one's a woman. But before we hired that male associate and that male student, we had one male partner, all the rest women. That, I think, is still pretty damn unusual. Might see it maybe in some family law. You know, you certainly see, you know, very small groups of women getting together to create a firm. So, you know, that's still noteworthy.
Right.
In a way that, I don't know, maybe people would take note today if you had a law firm of nine lawyers and there was only one woman. I sure notice it when I look at pictures of other law firms. So the demographics have changed, not as far and as fast as one would hope, but they've certainly changed. I think that has to be the biggest change I've seen in the legal profession in my time.
Can you describe any notable colleagues you've had, particularly graduates who we might be interested in interviewing? If any come to mind.
I just want to think.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots, but graduate of this school. Everyone I'm thinking of right now is not a graduate of this school. But I'm sure that's just because that's who I'm thinking of.
Well, we can always come back to it.
Okay, let me think about that one.
What would you say is... and this might be the case you already mentioned, but what would you say is the biggest accomplishment of your career so far, or the thing that you're the most proud of?
Well, Eldridge would be up there, but I actually don't think it's the answer. Yeah. I would say it was my work at the Human Rights Tribunal. I was really fortunate to come into the tribunal at a very exciting time. So I was appointed as a member in 2002, which was... the old human rights system was still, I don't know how familiar you are with human rights regimes, but it was still the old system at that point. So that meant we had a commission and a tribunal, the commission involved in their process of investigating complaints, attempting to mediate them, referring them to hearing or not before the tribunal.
Okay.
And I was appointed just at about the time that the then very controversial legislation was being introduced, which abolished the commission, made the tribunal what they like to call a direct access tribunal, really increased the scope of what the tribunal's work was going to be, because it meant that the tribunal was going to be the place that, although it wouldn't investigate complaints because that wasn't its statutory duty, it would be the first point of contact. And so we were going to have to establish procedures and law about how that whole process was going to work. Yes, there was a statute that gave some guidance, but as statutes do, it's only kind of skeletal.
Right.
So the chair at the time was Heather McNaughton, for whom I have a great deal of respect and would have answered in response to your earlier question, which is not a graduate of this law school. And there was a really good team of people there. And we worked really hard and had a lot of fun, in large part. And I was able to really shape in the jurisprudence of the tribunal in terms of what were we going to say the purposes of the code actually meant. How were we going to try and balance... the right of people, many of whom are self-represented and don't know how to, cannot possibly be expected to file and pursue a complaint, with the fairness rights of respondents who shouldn't be having to have to deal with frivolous or vexatious complaints,
right.
Do all of that in a fair, efficient, and transparent manner. And I think we did a really great job. And we did a really great job in a political atmosphere that was sometimes quite toxic. Because, you know, those were the years where Ezra Levant was, you know, talking about kangaroo courts.
Right.
And some leading members of our bar were really in a vitriolic manner, attacking the tribunal, its expertise, its decisions, its very existence. And that was a very difficult thing because, of course, we were not in a position to be able to respond,
right,
other than through our decisions.
Yeah.
hostility even from the courts in terms of the application of the standard of review in those days. So it, you know, it sometimes was a little embattled, but still the opportunity to really try and do my best to make human rights protection real within that context.
Right.
I was no fan of the old commission system. It'd be hard to find a fan of the old commission system just because it was so inefficient and so many delays. And even though it was probably created, I'm sure it was created with good intentions in terms of making human rights accessible, it didn't work.
Right.
There's problems with the direct access system too. So it wasn't a perfect system, but I'm very proud of the work I did within that context.
Great. And what do you hope to achieve in your career going forward?
Well, I hope to have a few years left. well, I love my practice now.
Yeah.
I really, really enjoy acting for trade unions, something I had not done previously.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I was suggesting before, really come to see how vital trade unions are as an engine for social justice in our society, even for non-unionized people, just in terms of raising the floor.
Right.
Seeing, you know, again, going back to human rights, so a fair bit of what I do, not all of it, but a fair bit of what I do is actually human rights within a labor context. So labor arbitrators have jurisdiction to apply the human rights code. And so there's lots and lots of cases that go forward in a labor arbitration context about oftentimes duty to accommodate, but various human rights issues. And when the union hires me, because the union's my client, mm-hmm. to act for it to represent that griever who has a human rights issue, I have resources. I have a client who has the financial resources, the sophistication, the commitment to enable me to do a decent job of representing that griever and giving him or her a fair shake in arbitration.
Right.
So expert reports, you know, whatever it is that I need in order to make that case, I generally speaking, I mean, unions aren't with limitless funds, but they're, you know,
Yeah. You
know, they are a sophisticated institutional entity. I compare that to those occasions when I'm, as I frequently am asked by individuals to act for them on human rights complaints.
Mm.
And it's not that the tribunal process is bad, it is that it is completely inaccessible to regular people. They can almost never afford a lawyer. It's a rare human rights complainant who has the means to actually be able to pay a lawyer.
Right.
In fact, the very people who need human rights protections the most are the ones who cannot afford to pay a lawyer.
Yeah.
So you're constantly being put in this position of saying no, or okay, I guess I can squeeze another pro bono case into my calendar.
Right.
And even then, you know, not having the resources to do things like the expert evidence and whatnot. And in the human rights tribunal regime, as it's currently interpreted, there's no provision for costs if you win. So you go through that whole process, and the chances that in a complex case that's been hard litigated, and they often are, that it's not a fluffy area of the law,
right.
The chances that your even if your complainant is successful, that they will get enough financially out of the case to compensate them for having paid you as a lawyer, it's very low. That is so frustrating. So I compare that to the situation of the person who might have exactly the same problem.
Right.
An employer who fired them because they were pregnant, or an employer who failed to accommodate their mental or physical disability, or a person who was racially harassed at work. They might have exactly the same problem. But the unionized worker has a hope that the non-unionized worker doesn't have.
Right.
So what do I want to do? I want to continue to act for those trade unions.
Right.
But I want to find ways and means to improve access to justice for human rights complainants, because it's a travesty.
Yeah. Do you have any advice you'd like to share with young lawyers or law students who might be listening to this interview?
I love giving advice.
Glad I asked that.
It's actually one of the things I love about, you know, my law firm with all the young lawyers we have, is the opportunity to act as a mentor. Advice to students or young lawyers. Only study law because you love it. You might not end up being a lawyer. As we all say, there's lots of things you can do with a law degree.
Yeah.
But don't go to law school and view it as a trade school. Like, we don't need more of those people. But if you have a passion for law, study it, get the most you can out of law school. Don't worry about what courses you take. Students ask me, what course should I take? So, well, you should take evidence. But beyond that, just like... maybe some civil procedure, but, you know, go for what excites you. Go for where the good professors are. You know, any law firm that down the road is going to care what classes you took is not a law firm you want to work for. I actually am very old-fashioned in some ways. I think law school, in a good sense, can teach you to think like a lawyer, and it doesn't matter if you're doing conflicts or real estate.
Right.
And to young lawyers... well, you got my sympathy, because it's a hard market, as you know. It's a hard time to be coming out. But we've seen that before. It's cyclical. Every generation, I think, goes through a time when the market's hard.
Right.
And, you know, the students that I talk to, that I work with, if they persevere, you know, they are able to find good positions. And then when you find yourself in that position, you know, make of it what you can. Don't be afraid to seek out opportunities to either within your firm or on your own time. You know, do pro bono work. Do things which, even if perhaps you're engaged in an area of practice which is not, you know, feeding your soul. Look for other opportunities to give back. Remember why it was you went to law school in the first place,
right,
which probably wasn't just to make a lot of money or to work a lot of hours.
Right.
Remember why you went to law school in the first place, and try and find opportunities, whether it's within the four corners of your practice or outside of it, to feed your soul, and in doing that, to help other people.
Do you have any final thoughts before we conclude?
I don't think so. That's it.
That's great. That's a good way to leave it off. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.